I'm Orville Schell, and I'm director of the Asia Society's new Center on U.S.-China Relations. And it's a great pleasure to be here with an old friend and colleague, Li Cheng, to consider the paradox that we confront when we confront China. And I think it deserves all the due diligence we can give it. Many of you, I know, have been to China, and it's hard not to be impressed by it as a foreigner, particularly in the large cities of China, which, if you had visited them as I did during the Cultural Revolution, Beijing, for instance, there was one single tall high-rise building in the whole city. And now you go and you cannot count the numbers of buildings that exist or that are still going up. And yet, beneath this miraculous and very dynamic new development, there are tremendous numbers of fissures, of uncertainties, and I think it would be fair to say that nowhere in the world is there a country of consequence that has more unresolved issues than China. In fact, I think one could describe it as a country sort of perennially in between transitions, not just in transition. And that is because it is trying to molt out of its old form that was laid down structurally in the early 50s when Stalin ruled the USSR and China viewed Stalin and Russia as its big brother. And so that's what we want to look at here today, are both the strengths and the weaknesses to try to assay something of a balance sheet. And I want to sort of caution you at first, if you find that notion somewhat confusing, I think you are in the right frame of mind to begin to understand China. Because indeed, the only way I think it is understandable is as something of a contradiction, as something in process where there are many, many phenomena, there are many trends and tendencies that we simply don't know how they're all going to end up. And meanwhile, it's going at an incredibly rapid rate. Now, to help us parse through this extraordinary country is Li Cheng, last name Li, who, interestingly enough, grew up in Shanghai and trained first as a medical doctor and then recycled himself, came to the United States, went to the University of California at Berkeley, where I first met him. After that, he went on to Princeton to do his PhD. Then he ended up doing a stint at a fellow at the Institute for Politics of Current World Affairs, studying China and studying some of the earlier village-level enterprises in the Yangtze Valley, and then became a professor at Hamilton College, and now is a senior fellow at Brookings, looking at contemporary China, its leadership, and its development. So we'll start off with Li Cheng, giving us a few sort of introductory comments. After that, we'll have a little conversation and then throw the floor open to you all for your questions. So, Li Cheng.
Well, I'm honored to be with you today in this elegant setting that invokes such a profound sense of intellectual community. I want to applaud the Aspen Institute and the DHL and their inspired board members for offering this great forum for intellectual, for international understanding, and for exploring the grand issues and new ideas of our time. I'm particularly humbled to speak along with Dean Orville Schell. When I came to the United States in 1985 to begin my graduate study at UC Berkeley, he was already a well-known China expert there. And as America's leading public intellectual on China, Orville has built platforms on which to raise other people, including myself, to greater vision and visibility. Orville, it is such an honor to be with you today, and I look forward to having your tutelage. Now, my task this afternoon is to talk about China's present and China's future, and to ponder what it means for us and for the United States. As we know, analyzing China's present or predicting China's future is not an easy job. China experts in the West have widely different views about the subject. As the older story goes, ask five China experts you will get 5 different answers, 6 if one of them went to Harvard. I apologize those in the room who went to Harvard. I know that there must be a lot of Harvard graduates here. Now, a recent report on China by Council on Foreign Relations, Relations Task Force, on which I serve as a member, observed that China is a paradox of numerous countries, modern and ancient, dynamic and stagnant, harmonious and diverse, strong and weak, rich and poor, communist and capitalist, bureaucratic and efficient, innovative, imitative, the passive and aggressive, repressive and free-willing. Now, the greatest paradox in China, in my view, relates to its future, which is paradox of hope and fear. An understanding of this paradox will help us forecast China's future trajectory and to understand its policy options. In the next 12 minutes or so, I will first briefly discuss the fear factors, including various sorts of major problems that China has or will have, and then explain why I believe that despite all these challenges, the future of China is primarily a story of hope, not fear, for both China and the world. I will particularly highlight the idea of an emerging democratic China. Now, during the past academic year, I visited China altogether 7 times. During these visits, I had the privilege to meet with China's senior leaders, including Premier Wen Jiabao. Last week, for instance, as a member of a U.S. think tank delegation, I visited a dozen ministries in Beijing, including commerce and foreign affairs, and etc. In all these meetings, Chinese senior leaders were very candid about the serious problems that China confronts, such as economic disparity, environment degradation, unemployment pressures, shortage of natural resources, and food safety. Unemployment pressure, for example, will be overwhelming as the country's working age population reaches 950 million by 2025, compared with 750 million today. How to create jobs for 200 million people is probably the most daunting challenge for the Chinese government. Demographical conditions will likely deteriorate. According to Premier Wen Jiabao, among the 45 kinds of principal mineral reserves that China currently possesses, only 6 will be sufficient to meet the country's need in 2020. Now, meanwhile, the ongoing large-scale industrialization makes the country's environmental challenges more acute. China is already the 3rd largest auto market in the world, and motor vehicles consume 1/3 of the country's oil. Today, 400 million Chinese people live in areas with dangerous high levels of air pollution. Almost the entire urban population live very dangerously. China's current medical and health service system is awfully inadequate. Besides, China is already rapidly aging and becoming an aging society. Now, it is not difficult to imagine China's future leaders may shift the domestic problem by pursuing an economically expansionist foreign policy. As we know, Hu Jintao recently visited Africa. His visit not only reflects China's global economic and energy interests, but also reflects China's global economic strategy, which wants to start with the regions like Africa, South America, and other regions like the Middle East, but gradually expand to North America and Europe. In about 10 years, Chinese cars, for example, will have a significant share of the American market. So far, China's external behaviors are largely motivated by these economic interests. These activities probably in the long run will cause some tensions as the redistribution of wealth always will cause more problems. Now, but also interesting enough, if we look at today's world, the countries are doing the best or making the major progress are also the countries, you know, have the serious problems in terms of natural resources. The examples like Japan, China, and India. And also Japan's success also tell us that it could be achieved without environmental catastrophes. Now, in addition, current top Chinese leaders have already done more than any of their predecessors to draw public attention to countries' pressing environment problems. Some new development strategies may contribute to the continued growth for China in the next 2 or 3 decades. The examples including China's pursuing more balanced regional development, promoting domestic demand-driven growth, paying great attention to so-called green GDP, and funding technological research and innovation, especially in the areas of biotechnology and nanotechnology. China's cheap labor costs and the huge domestic market will continue to remain China's advantages. Now, as we know, the most pessimistic view among China watchers in the West concentrate on China's political arena. But I believe that we should not overlook the important dynamic forces for change on the political front. In my judgment, China's greatest hope probably lies in the transformation of its political system in the next decade and beyond. Please allow me to add a personal note, because I want to be clear, I'm not a fan of the Chinese Communist Party. My family suffered a great deal under communist rule. My father was a factory owner before the 1949 revolution, and my mother was a teacher at the Roman Catholic Church. My childhood was largely spent in constant fear, especially escaping the Red Terror. The worst thing that happened to my family was to my brother, who just graduated from Fudan University. And in 1967, 40 years ago, he was beaten to death by Red Guards in Hunan. The crime, he was listening to the radio of Voice America. Now, you can imagine how appreciative I have been for the things that I later found in my adopted country: democracy, freedom, civil rights, and tranquility. I have also become particularly sensitive about the democratic future of my native land. I have come to realize that some important demographic, technological, and socio-political trends at present have the potential to transform China into a democratic country within 10 to 15 years. Let me briefly highlight 4 major trends in the country and explain how they will contribute to a democratic China. Because of time concern, I will very quickly look at the two, three things. One is the rise of middle class. According to McKinsey's report, by the year 2025, that China will have middle class, the size is 520 million people. Well, this is just, of course, debatable, the definition, but still, just a sizable middle class will emerge. China's political landscape will forever change. The second is the telecommunication revolution. Just to give an example, the mobile phone. 1995, China had a mobile phone about 94,000. And then increased exponentially, double every year. Last year, it's 440 billion. People would love to use short messages to send greetings, spread rumors, and spread jokes, you know. And last Spring Festival, just within 1 week, China Mobile submitted 3 billion short messages. They're not free, 2 cents for each. So the company, just that within that week, made $300 million. You can imagine that kind of development. The third is the rise of NGOs, lawyers, and other civil rights groups. Just for example, lawyers. And last year, a total of 620 law schools and law departments produced 100,000 lawyers. The growth rate is faster than the United States, for better or worse. You know, 2 years ago, China had a total 100,000 lawyers, but now each year they produce 100,000 law students. But the most important thing is that it's not these three areas, mostly in society, but also in the political system, as Professor McFarquhar mentioned. Within the political system, also there's some interesting changes. the new groups become elites, like technocrats, lawyers, and foreign-trained retainees. But also, not only the elite leadership become increasingly diversified, but also there's an introduction of a checks and balance within the leadership. This is what I call the new idea or new experiment of Chinese democracy. Now, they want to start within the party, although they will not allow the opposition party to exist, but they will allow the checks and balances, these ideas, introduced into the Communist Party. Although that faction politics is not transparent, not legitimate, but if you ask any taxi driver in China, they will tell you which one belongs to which faction. Now, one faction led by former party boss Jiang Zemin and the currently Vice President Zheng Qinhong, we may call it elitist coalition. They represent the interests of coastal region, entrepreneurs, middle class, and the princelings, children of high-ranking officials, and the well-developed coastal region, we may call them China's blue states. The other faction or coalition, led by current General Secretary Hu Jintao and Premier Wen Jiabao, and consists of the local leaders, grassroots leaders, and the less privileged social groups, and they usually have their power base in China's inland. We call them China's red states. Now, they compete against each other. And as time goes on, their demand, their competition will become increasingly transparent and legitimate, and general election will become also likely. Now, if that scenario is correct, and in 10 to 15 years, that party may split into two, you know, parties, and therefore that the social group can find their representative, and gradually this inner party democracy will expand to the real constitutional democracy. Now, very quickly conclude my discussion on China as a paradox of hope and fear with a quote by Sir Francis Bacon. He said, I quote, "Hope is a good breakfast, but it is a poor supper." Now, I'm optimistic at this point based on the remarkable progress made in China during the past two decades. I believe that these progresses are generally in line with both American values and American interests. We need to deal with China wisely, not dogmatically. Despite all the cultural and the political differences, the United States and China share many common interests, and in a broad sense, a common destiny. It is in our best interest to help China to become a cooperative, responsible, and democratic member of the international community. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Let's start. I'd like to ask you a little bit about, just so the audience will understand how your consciousness evolved and how you look at China. What were your first impressions of the West growing up and coming out of the Cultural Revolution, and how did those begin to change? And how did you ultimately decide to come to this country?
Well, I came to this country in 1985. At that time, it's probably the best possible future for my generation is to come to abroad. And usually when we came, we thought we want to stay in the United States because there's a hope. At that time, China, it's the early stage of development, to a certain extent, hopeless. And I was fascinated by, the wealth and also the freedom, etc. I remember that actually the most the memorable things, I went to an ice cream store introduced by my friend Annie Chang, who was a librarian, a Taiwanese. And then I was fascinated by so many kinds of varieties of ice creams. At that time, when I came in 1985, in China, there was only one kind of ice cream. That was vanilla ice cream, but more ice than cream. So, but like 40 or 50 kinds of ice cream. But of course, my friend, Annie Chang, she wants to tell me about the diversity of choices in this country, not just the eating ice cream. So that's my first strongest impact, but also the wells, the highways, all these kind of things. But now, 20 years later, I have nephews and niece. They also want to come to the United States, although not necessarily the top choice. They probably also want to invest, do some work in China, business growth, et cetera. But also one interesting difference between their generation and my generation is that most of them want to go back to China. Now, this is also perception change. When we came, we thought staying in the United States is the future. But they said that now if you stay in the United States, not necessarily means that you are successful. Or return to China, not necessarily mean you are a failure. Because tremendous opportunity. And as we know that when Nixon, I mean, not Nixon, Carter, talked to Deng Xiaoping in 1979, asked China, really open China into immigration, he asked Deng Xiaoping, you should really send students, you know, to the United States. Then Deng Xiaoping asked him, how many you want? You know, then Deng Xiaoping actually said, what about 1 million? But during the past almost 3 decades, China did send 1 million students overseas, not only in the United States, but also Europe and Japan, et cetera, most of these Western countries. And 1/3 of them already returned, 1/3 of them still in the program, and 1/3 of them, like myself, decided to stay in the United States. But that also tells us about the hope of China. If China is hopeless, no young people want to go back. But now the hope largely in the academic or economic arena, particularly economic and business circles, because you can make more money. But also we're gradually expanding other disciplines, media, law, and consultant firms, journalism, and even the government.
I mean, obviously, as China develops, becomes more powerful, the chemistry between it and this country change. How have you seen in the last, say, 5 to 10 years, attitudes amongst your friends who've stayed in China towards the United States have evolved?
Well, it's really China become increasingly diversified. It depends on what kind of people you ask, even depends on what time you ask them. And still, people have tremendous respect, admiration for America. But also, there's some cynicism about American foreign policies. And they are really unhappy, some of the situation. They still have a different perspective. For example, recently we have the SED dialogue, the Strategic Economic Dialogue in the United States. Most people in this country are actually quite critical about the result, think that China has never
compromised. This is Hank Paulson's.
It's Hank Paulson with Wu Yi. But I talked to China's trade ministers, or the deputy ministers, and other scholars. They are just puzzled. You know, we came to the United States, we purchased, you know, $20 billion and Boeings and et cetera, and we try to be accommodated, but still so much criticism from the United States. And of course, some of their concerns are legitimate, some are not, right? I talk about the currency exchange and et cetera, and trade deficit. They have a different perspective. So I certainly, of course, these people are well informed. They can, you know, read the internet and et cetera, but they have their more nationalistic perspective. So in trade area and also in some other areas, the potential is there some conflicts. But on the other hand, there's a movement that China and the United States in so many ways linked together, culturally, economically, even, you know, male to male, military to military. There's a lot of things going on. And for the moment, they are quite optimistic. But they are also worried about the so-called China threat or anti-China things. But that's not a dominant mood. The most important, they want to continue to have a good relationship with the United States.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that at one point, this idea of exporting American democracy, everybody just sort of took it as a granted. And now nationalist tendencies in China very often, I think, feel somewhat indignant at the idea that the U.S. wants to preach to it, evangelize for democracy. What do you think has changed there?
This is a very good question. In 1989, during the Tiananmen period, of course, you do see some young Chinese students were very enthusiastic about democracy, very much inspired by liberty and et cetera. And then some decline in the 1990s because the people only interested in making money. You know, this commercialism become dominant. But now there's a revival of the demand, largely because of China's rise. There are also some people, at least some intellectuals, believe that China should also have a good political system, more democratic system to accommodate the rise of economic China. So that kind of voices already start to emerge, like Yu Keping, who worked for the Central Committee. Even some top leaders like Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao constantly talk about democracy. And Hu Jintao even said, without democracy, without modernization. This is exactly what Yi Jinsheng said in the 1970s.
But of course, they meant very different things.
Well, but still, but when you open that door, you really open the new debate, new discussions, mm-hmm. right? And of course, that they talk about Chinese democracy, but I also met Dai Bingguo, who is in charge of China's foreign ministry, will very quickly become either vice premier or state councillor. He talked about democracy, on one hand, should have Chinese characteristics, but on the other hand, should be universal. He also used the example as a cup. You know, there's different cups. You know, there's different style, different things made, but they're cups. The democracy, some basic, you know, elements should be same, but also should have its own unique characteristic. So you do see, you know, after Tiananmen, now there are a lot of Chinese start to talk about democracy. And in my judgment, probably will be more so in the years to come for several reasons. One is society has changed, you see, with this rise of middle class, with social groups, and et cetera. Second, the leadership realize there are lack of legitimacy. There are so many jokes about the Chinese Communist Party. Let me share you with one. I said, this is actually, I got it from the short message, you know, service, and a few years ago. Three, you know, leaders, state leaders, President Bush, President Putin, and President Hu Jintao are having a walk in a forest after summit. They all blocked by a group of wolves, you know, animals, W-O-L-V-E-S, wolves. Then President Bush went to the wolves, told them, if you don't leave, I will launch missile to kill you. No reaction. Then President Putin went to the wolves, said, if you don't leave, I will release poison gas to kill you. No reaction either. Then observing lack of success of his two colleagues, Hu Jintao smiled, and he said, let me try. He went to the wolves and said a few words. Wolf immediately, you know, disappeared. Then President Putin and President Bush asked him, what's your secret weapon? He said, I just told them, if you did not leave, I will make sure they will live the rule of the Chinese Communist Party. So this is worse than death, you know. So party knows it's unpopular, and it has to change, and it does not have legitimacy. It has problem to select top leaders. But of course, they won't do so in an incremental way, a step by step. On one hand, more rule of law than democracy. In terms of law, in terms of election, rather than general election, because this really will, in their view, will lead to chaos, but rather from the grassroots and for general election, but also within party, for so-called inner party democracy, maybe central committee members will select the top leader. But also, Wen Jiabao makes it very clear, this is not the end of the China's change. Wen Jiabao, and as she told the Brookings Group, I was a member, he said, if the election, local election, can be achieved in the township level, can also be achieved in the county level, municipal level, and also provincial level. So this gradual change. So this is their experiment. This is their idea. But of course, we don't know whether it can succeed or not. But compared with some other options, this is probably the best way for China, because this can avoid the violent split, violent transition.
Well, of course, all this depends, doesn't it, on whether the economy remains vibrant. And China's economy is vibrant indeed, almost 11% growth rate, which is unprecedented in any country at any time in any history that we know of. Do you imagine that the economy can continue to grow at this rate? Because if it can't, then, of course, the whole political prospect of this country being able to evolve slowly, piecemeal, as you propose, as the best scenario, would be uncertain.
Well, of course, that, you know, someone asked about whether the stock market will go up and go down. Of course, it will go up and go down. But the important thing is what the timing, when they will drop, when they will have some clash, or then when they will recover. That's probably even far more important. But certainly this question is in many people's mind. I was in China as a fellow in 1993 to 95. At that time, foreign journalists like Reuters, BBCs, and the Washington Post, New York Times, we all talk about China's collapse, upcoming collapse of the real estate, and look at the property booming at that time, and there's an oversupply. But talk about for 20 years. But this is still the property, you know, the real estate in China, in Shanghai, in coastal region, continue to go up.
the central leadership actually tried very hard to cool down this, what they called the economical overheating. But it's still going up. It's largely because of the Chinese economy, rise of middle class, rise of consumerism, and et cetera. But also the government recently made a major shift. They from the coast region development to China's inland development, from the pure GDP growth to talk about green GDP and social justice, social welfare. This actually continued to stimulate Chinese economic rise. Now, I was in Chongqing last October. You know, I visited three times. The previous time is 3 years ago and 10 years ago. And the last trip, October trip, was just amazed by so many high rises. And the Chongqing mayor told us, our delegation, he said, Chongqing now has more cranes than Shanghai does. But as we know, Shanghai a few years ago claimed it hosted 1/6 of cranes, but now already moved to Chongqing, this kind of development. For by doing this kind of shift, strategic development shift actually helped China, or save China in economic term. I think in near term, and I think China will maintain economic growth. But it has faced a lot of problems. The good thing is because they have the low cost of labor, domestic market, and the Chinese people's willingness to learn from others.
Well, let's talk about these problems a bit, because they are indeed legion. I just saw an interesting report that the World Bank had, in a report on China, had noted that by its estimate, some 750,000 people die prematurely each year in China from air pollution. Yeah. The State Environmental Protection Administration had asked that this be removed, deleted, from the final public report because they didn't want to frighten people. Now, it seems to me we, on the resource end of things, China is really up against a pretty inflexible edge of the envelope in terms of air pollution, water use, I mean, you name it. How is it going to be possible, in your view, for them to keep this kind of hyper growth and still wrestle with the environmental contradiction?
I think it's a very important question. And during my visits in China, I'd say the most frequent question we raise and they answer in substantial way is environment problem. They realize that problem. Actually, you refer to that someone wants to hide that number. Actually, just last week, the National People's Congress is debating, try to pass this called emergency law. This law tried to protect the journalists. If the emergency situation, journalists should go out to release these kind of terrible statistics. And also, we know that started 2 years ago, the Chinese leadership released the number of social protests, as Professor McCracken mentioned in the early session. Now, we may ask why they released that, because...
Well, we're not sure they actually intended to release it quite so publicly.
No, it's intended. It's intended. It's released.
You
by Xiaoyong.
It was intended.
Yeah, by Xiaoyong. It's Hu Jintao's protege. They did that. And even Wen Jiabao actually was angry in the meeting. They also released some even more ugly things, like the child labor, slavery issues. Mm. It's so ugly, so disgusting. Mm. Everyone heard this story in Shanxi province that child laborers used, you know, really treated, it's really slavery, basically. Mm. Now, the environment problem is very serious. You know, each time I visit Beijing, Shanghai, I do not see the improvement at all. Someone said it's improved. I do not see that because the automobiles in Beijing has 3 million automobiles. 10 years ago, private automobile almost zero, from zero to 3 million. We talked to Beijing mayor. Wang Jishan actually is a rising star. I don't think he has a clear understanding of the importance of environment, and he even said we want to get a revenue for these automobiles. And now recently he even making jokes about foreigners. Whenever I talk about the global warming, people will like me, you know, this kind of attitude. So they did not realize how serious it is. But at the same time, some leaders like Pan Yue, you know, the vice minister of China's Environmental Protection Bureau, he said very bluntly, he said that China's economic miracle is, there's no miracle at all when you consider this environment cost. So top leaders talk about this environment problem. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it's too late or too little, but you do see the trends both working on that. And but the deaths and the cost by this environment pollution, the lack of water, and also talk about lack of water. As we know, that's 300 million people, about 200 to 300 million, as Professor Wu Weiming early mentioned in the early section, will move from rural area to urban area. According to Chinese official study, Each individual migrant moved from rural area to urban area. His or her need for water will increase by 30 times. Where you get this water? But at the same time, also look at the past 5 years, 3 or 4 years. The companies doing the best, foreign investment companies or Chinese domestic companies doing the best, usually the environment product companies. Mm-hmm. They're doing extremely well in all parts of China in terms of environment protection. So you do see this kind of thing.
I mean, I think there's enormous progress on the environmental front, but at the same time, the aggregate of growth so far outstrips the progress that we're constantly falling behind.
I agree. China is already paying a huge cost. Will continue to pay a huge cost. Yeah. Now, if someone talk about the possible really crisis for China, it's a real crisis, probably will occur in healthcare front or environment front, these kind of disasters. But on the other hand, it's also interesting, when I grew up in China in early 60s, as a kid, we asked to write cartoons about the beauty of China, and almost all kids will draw a cartoon, Tiananmen Square, then, in the back is chimneys leaking dark smoke. Because Chairman Mao said in early 1960s, when he stood on Tiananmen Square, he wanted to see all the industrialization signals, chimneys, pollutions. But of course, that was 40 some years ago. But now it's certainly not that kind of picture. People do have the consciousness. But compared with some other countries, still in the early stage, I think that we should make a lot of noises to make China to improve environment and other norms and standards, international norms and standards. And they are aware of that, but just we hope to do more.
Well, since we're largely Americans here, tell us what you would recommend in a concise form the next president of the United States adopt as a China policy. I mean, this is the most important bilateral relationship in the world. What should we do we're not doing?
I think that we continue to emphasize we are in the same boat. And the problem we face, the most daunting challenges with anti-terrorism and global warming and environment and health crisis, all other kinds of things. We need China to be a responsible member. And United States is willing to help China. But at the same time, we should respect China, not just give them lectures about democracy, but also respect their own search, their own experiments. If we constantly deny that whatever you have been doing is no democracy, will not meet our standards, that will not work. We should emphasize the cultural differences, the diversities, the norm, and et cetera. I think, on the one hand, emphasize on our differences, but also at the same time, emphasize our shared destiny. That will work. That will be very persuasive for the Chinese.
So if you were the CEO of a company and you were thinking to yourself, boy, I better get to China if I'm not already there, what would your advice be?
Well, you should not be in the business of the manufacturer, because that battle probably is already over. China won. But we probably in some other areas, like service sectors, all kinds of services, China desperately need foreign expertise. And also, just to give you an example, consultants or psychological counseling is also, well, if you can speak Chinese, right, also will be very, very helpful, because these rich entrepreneurs or middle class or these single-child family children, they have a lot of psychological problems.
So this raises the question of values, doesn't it?
Sure, of course, yeah.
Your family was a Christian family.
Yes, right.
How do you analyze this vacuum of values and culture that we've spoken about?
Well, in a way, earlier? It's true, because to a certain extent, it's because of the legacies of the Cultural Revolution and the legacies of the rapid rush for materialism, for commercialization during the 90s. So China was really hit by these two major events. Cultural Revolution made you do not believe anything. And then the commercialism only made you believe in money. Money worship. So that's a really very unfortunate thing. I think Chinese leaders realize that. And so that's why they want to talk about the social cohesion, harmonious society, and et cetera. And so it is in an early stage of development. If you ask me what I worry most, I actually worry about this lack of value system. But at the same time, we also see in certain parts of the world, you know, becomes people obsessed with ideology, obsessed with certain religions. This is also quite dangerous. So I think China should find a way, go to some way in between. And we really do not know the numbers of the number of religious believers in China. And some of the numbers are highly exaggerated. So we don't know the number. But based on my visit in China, still religious, you know, believers, the number is still not that big in both urban and the rural areas. But of course, it's only based on my own experience. And so I think that's an area China should make it should pay great attention. And otherwise, the rise of China is become just an empty slogan because you do not have a sound political system to support. You do not have a value system. Will only bring more trouble to the people.
Why don't we open it up to the floor for questions from you all? Let's see. Let's start. Why don't you line up with the mic because that way everybody can hear your question more easily. Yes, please.
Something that you touched upon, which I'd like you to expand further. I don't think a democracy can exist without freedom of the press. I don't think it can be sustained. And nor do I think any of these pollution problems or other problems that exist can be fully explored without freedom of the press. Could you describe what you think the future is for freedom of the press in China?
Yeah. One of the things my father, late father, taught me, I still remember some of the conversation. He said, don't believe anything about Chinese media, Chinese newspaper said. Everything could be fake one, except a date and the dates. The weather can be fake one, right? Because it could be highly political, right? And he said that about 15, 20 years ago. And but that time, China had only 5 newspapers, 3 or 4 TV stations. But now China, actually I visited the China's radio and films ministry. They gave me the number, 3,000 TV stations, thousands of newspapers. Yes, sometimes they still, you know, censor people. Sometimes they arrest some journalists. And the Chinese use a term called kill chicken to skill the monkeys. Kill chicken to skill the monkeys. But now there are so many chickens. Monkeys are not scared. So in many ways, you see, if you look at Chinese media, whether print media, particular books and magazines, and also TV programs, there are some very good, you know, programs. And the dominant theme in Chinese TV is anti-corruption. Yes, I don't think China has a free media at the moment, but with this kind of commercialization, and also in the next few months, that 30,000 foreign journalists will be in China. Mm-hmm. Right now, the number is about 500. And 15 years ago, when I was in China, only 60. So you see this kind of expand. Not only foreign journalists, but also Chinese journalists. Some of them are very, very talented. They want to push the envelope. They claim the media freedom. I think the time will arrive, actually, not far away, also about 10 to 15 years period, the independence of media separate. Of course, this is a battle, you know, will continue to go on. But who will be winner, who will be loser, is quite clear. Early on, I talked about the cell phone, talk about the short messages. You basically really cannot control.
And the internet is internet. Not to be forgotten.
That's right, yeah. And also internet. There's so many things going on. So I think media will play a positive role in that process.
Next.
My question concerns China's energy future and whether it will be driven by hope or by fear. I guess today you could describe China's going out policy and its no strings policy as driven by fear of the market, fear that if it applies environmental or human rights standards, it won't be able to get the energy it needs. There is another path, and that's being part of the collective energy security system, trusting the market, applying the same standards, because China and the U.S. probably have more in common as energy consumers than anyone else. But what are the prospects for China adopting that kind of a shift in policy? And how much does the Taiwan issue, the fear that the U.S. will interrupt Chinese oil supply in the event of a conflict, drive China's insecurity?
Well, very good question. On one hand, most people in Washington, D.C., particularly experts in the energy sector, believe that China's growing demand for oil, for energy, actually will make U.S.-China cooperation more likely because we have shared interests, common interests. We can help each other. We can set up the standards to meet. And also, secondly, in everywhere in the world, people are doing research, try to find alternative energy. And of course, I'm not a scientist because I visited several forecast meetings. One of the predictions about 2020 is actually the global oil price was going down rather than going up because of alternative energy. I'm not an expert, but based on several actually quite major studies. So this can also help. And but the demand, the China's demand of oil is real. And the problem is, I think, that in the near future still, it's the biggest challenge, one of the biggest challenges for Chinese government. And they constantly talk about that. But in terms of Taiwan, I think probably usually we're not linked to the energy issues. Of course, some Chinese military strategists also think that could be a serious challenge. We cut off China's, you know, overseas supply. But that's why China desperately needs you know, other areas like Russia and elsewhere, right, in the Central Asia. And but the most important concern at the moment, people are not in China not worried about Taiwan issues. They think time is on China's side. So long China play safely, probably will not make things worse. And they also believe the next Taiwan election, the Kuomintang pro-unification, or long-term unification force will win, then the issues will change dramatically in that area. So this is their current reading.
Next.
It was a three-part question till you just talked about Taiwan. Two parts. What is the role and the situation of the military in China today? And can you envisage when the economy inevitably drops and you have a huge problem with unemployment, as has been done in so many developing countries, the military makes a diversion, expanding, attacking, or what may happen there?
Yeah, these are also very good questions. First, in the military, most experts on Chinese military modernization believe that at the moment, military is just one of the bureaucratic institutions. Sometimes they have a lot of say in terms of budget. But the military interference in domestic politics becoming like a kingmaker, like what happened in the 1980s or earlier, actually is quite unlikely because they really insulate the military from the domestic politics. And I also belong to that group, majority of China analysts. But at the same time, we do know some potential problem. The problem is China's civilian leadership is moving from technocrats to some other group, more diversified groups. But China's military become real technocratic. These people went to school, not go through the other step-by-step by the army or navy, but through the high-tech academies, then become military officers. And the civilian leaders do not have any military experience, unlike some of our president or presidential candidates have military experience. So for agents, soldiers or pilots, they have no experience at all. Chinese leadership noticed that. So from time to time, they train some of the provincial leaders to the National Defense University for 3 months or half a year training into military strategy, military work, but probably still will not work. So I think the problem is 15, 20 years down the road when these young technocrats become to the top national military leadership, they may challenge the experience or knowledge of the civilian leadership, but not now. They are still in the low ranking, the military. Now, the second question about the economic problem, of course, things could go wrong. China's stock market go up and down several times during the past few months. But I think the real crisis could really hit severely. It should be global scale financial crisis, not China domestic and problem. And then that crisis also hit the middle class, Chinese middle class, and everyone become losers. Then could be serious problem, but that should be global scale. And I don't know anyone has answer about that. But now there are so many forces and institutional arrangement or mechanisms try to prevent this kind of thing things happening. To a certain extent, this is also why United States and China are also in the same boat on the economic front. It will hurt all of us in a very severe way.
And yet it's worth pointing out that we've seen several examples of these bubbles.
Yes.
We've seen Japan, we've seen Southeast Asia, we've seen Silicon Valley. There is a kind of an ineluctable tendency for these very hyper growth types of bubbles to eventually have some and whether it's global or domestic.
Yeah, the one thing is that the Politburo meetings constantly talk about overheating in Chinese economy, basically try to prevent this kind of thing occurrence. Mm-hmm. So in my view, if top leaders, national leaders, fully aware of these problems, they try to, actually you can see that during the past few weeks, they constantly use some kind of policy mechanism to try to reduce this kind of possibility. The bubbles of real estate, bubbles of the stock market, et cetera. Probably it's not worth time for them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Next, please.
I was just recently in China and admired the way everything is going. It's fantastic. But just recently, with the terrible reports about pet food, toothpaste, tires, meats, seafood coming out of China being contaminated in many ways, how does this must affect the economy tremendously? Because we've been told not to get anything that was made or produced in China.
Well, actually, I talked to some of Chinese officials. They also, first, they acknowledged their problems. But then they also said that some of the companies you mentioned or products you mentioned, not Chinese products, the joint ventures with American companies. So they just to say that they're completely blaming China is unfair for these things. But at the same time, they realize how dangerous if they continue to do not pay much attention to food safety or drug safety and not reach a high standard. I do believe that their standard is lower than many other countries. And also that kind of making money, this mentality quickly also prevents some of the procedures to implement it. But I think, I hope the recent events, like what you said, that toothpaste and other things, toils, will give them a wake-up call. At the moment, they also concern about whether this kind of stories in the U.S. media or international media will hurt China, along with Darfur, the Sudan's genocide about the Olympics. They still think for short term, not realize that this is simply just terribly wrong, should be corrected. And but the issues raised are very much true. And I live in China. In many ways, this is, deal with them daily on a daily basis. I'm very suspicious about the water or many other things. But at the same time, you do see the standard increase over the past 10 to 15 years, but it's still probably not enough to our standard.
You know, it's interesting to note, I mean, China has grown so rapidly, but its regulatory structure has not. For example, the State Environmental Protection Administration, which is supposed to minister the whole country, 1.3 billion people, has something like 300 people in it. Whereas our Environmental Protection Agency, which ministers to far less people, has well over 50,000 people. So this will give you an idea of the, we are in a kind of a deregulatory mode ourselves, but China hasn't had a chance really to get into a regulatory mode in this particular way.
But also interesting,
yes.
They are also very suspicious about some products imported from U.S. in the gene, and like orange. They said the U.S. Export orange to China never lloyed. If you put 1 year, still just like fresh. They're suspicious. There's something wrong with that. The tomato is so big, so beautiful. They also doubt whether they have some impact for their health. So I always debate with them. I think it's safe, but how can I absolutely say that it's safe?
Next,
my question goes back to military issues. I'm wondering why you think the Chinese military modernization is going forward with such a lack of transparency, and if you think this is dangerous given American leaders' tendency to view the world as a zero-sum game.
Well, yeah, I visited just last Friday. I talked to the director of foreign affairs of the Ministry of Defense in China, raised the issue of transparency, along with my colleague David Schambach. And two of us met that guy. And he certainly think that your criticism of transparency is, using an absolute term, is unfair. Transparency should be a relative term. He argued that no country's military could be, could have real transparent. But at the same time, if you look at our standard or East Asian country standard with Chinese standards, certainly there's a gap. But of course, look at China's previous, look at the Chinese military history. There's tremendous materials available. and a tremendous amount of information available. And David Schambacher and I both did a lot of research. You know, without accessing all this information, certainly we cannot write these kind of things. So, but for them, they still use the previous kind of concept, obsessed with previous concept. Some of the things really should be open to the public, they do not. And but on the other hand, they just thought that if we transparent and let you to visit us, then you have more criticism of us. So what's the point to release all this information to you? So actually, they released some of the sites for foreign journalists. Then you see the wave of the criticism from American media newspapers talk about the problems, the dangers, the lack of responsibility, or lack of the crisis management system. So then they said probably it's no point to be transparent. So this is their mindset. And but of course, we're still in the process of negotiation. Our military-to-military contacts still can continue to go on. I foresee there will be more these kind of exchanges, and these kind of exchanges will eventually will make them more open in certain areas.
Lee Chang, talk for a minute about the perceived Chinese military threat. How do you look at that? I mean, you live on both sides of the divide.
Well, I think we should be aware. I think no one knows whether China will be a threat or not, because this is something 15 years down the road. Compared with now, China's military is far away, you know, far behind of the United States. The many studies consider it's about 20 to 30 years behind. They themselves acknowledge they cannot compete with the United States. But two things we should be worried. Both, one is its weaknesses, one is its strengths. The strength is their military strategy is not just compete with you in absolute term, but rather is what they call asymmetrical, you know, approach. Asymmetrical warfare, which is just to destroy certain things, maybe the computer system, will completely jeopardize your military strength. So this should be worrisome. Secondly, it's their weaknesses. Sometimes their system probably not work, the lack of coordination and et cetera. This can also cause a lot of confusion. But in terms of absolute term, 20 to 25 years, it's just one generation. One generation we need to prepare, right? So I think consider all these aspects, we certainly should be worried about China's future military potential. But in terms of China's military strategy, it's quite clear. It does not have any lack of transparency. It's to try to win a regional war under high technology, which means to win a war over Taiwan with high technology. This is their strategy. It's not targeted Japan, not targeted United States. And I think that strategy is real. So to a certain extent, it's still, they call it defensive, you know, or active or defensive regarding that area. So there's no kind of a long-term strategy competing with the United States based on right now. But on the 20 years down the road, we don't know. So it's a good question. But we should not be, you know, kind of exaggerating the situation and then prepare accordingly in terms of military spending increase, but rather just to act wisely to how to deal with China's strategy, like asymmetrical warfare, and how to help China to be more transparent to avoid the confusions or its weaknesses in terms of communication and et cetera.
Okay, now we have about 5-6 minutes left. Let's see if we can get all three of you in. Maybe quick questions, quick answers. Next.
I work with a human rights NGO that works on promoting fairer globalization, particularly on promoting economic and social rights and working on business and human rights, and a special focus on Africa. We hope that...
What's the name of your organization?
It's called Realizing Rights, the Ethical Globalization Initiative, founded by Mary Robinson, who as UN High Commissioner made several trips to China. And based partly on her experience, but generally we hope that there are ways and opportunities that with the increasing Chinese official investment in Africa and commercial investment in Africa, that there may be ways that human rights can be respected. Of course, Western countries don't have a great record here so far. What do you see as opportunities for China respecting human rights as it increases its investment in Africa?
Well, in terms of domestic human rights issue, actually China improved in many fronts. Of course, there's still some problem. But in terms of concept of international human rights, particularly issue about Africa and Sudan, I don't think they really want to do something real to improve. Rather, they're concerned about Olympics.
Well, that may force them into some sort of...
But after Olympics, they probably will not do anything. You know, because actually Chinese officials talked to me. He said they were surprised by the strong reaction about a genocide or Olympic, the term. They're very much worried. So actually, I said that you do need to improve the human rights, the more conscious interest about the human rights issues, about genocide issues in Sudan. They listen to it. They probably will do something, but just for the sake of the Olympic. And for international human rights, I still think, on the one hand, they think the United States or other Western countries have double standard. You also support a lot of dictators and et cetera. You also turn blind eyes to some of the human rights violations. So now single out China just for try to embarrass China or try to contain China. This is their mindset. Not all leaders. Probably some leaders think that China should improve in that area. Think it's not a good idea to be always with these kind of bad guys, North Korea and Cuba and Sudan. But the majority of them, just for strategic thing, I think their consciousness is quite weak. And I don't know how to improve that. I don't know, to be honest. It's still very hard. Yeah.
Okay, last two questions. Make them brief, please.
It's understandable that our panels would treat the development of international relations as largely a result of changes in Europe, in China, while viewing the United States as relatively constant, the exception of faux pas like Iraq. In fact, it seems to me that's a somewhat static definition of what really is a dynamic relationship in which there have been major changes in the U.S., including in the 22 years that you were here. The U.S. no longer, it seems to me, has the position of enlightened leadership in the world. We have a kind of reciprocal relationship as compared with China. If China has dynamic growth without stability, the U.S., it seems to me, one could make the case, has achieved stability with a kind of stagnation. It's hard to be convinced that the 2008 election is going to entirely reverse that. It's hard to see forces within the United States which can bring about the changes to recreate the kind of enlightened leadership this country once had. I wonder what you've seen over the 22 years. I wonder what China could contribute in a dialogue with us to be able to bring about the kind of growth and enlightenment that the U.S. has had. Ironically, it reminds me of the discredited Mao statement that you need a revolution every 5 years. We need something. What could China help us?
Jefferson, wasn't it?
Perhaps, but also Mao.
Well, China tried very hard to avoid to be a leader of some groups or some kind of a coalition or camps, particularly vis-a-vis with the United States. They have been very cautious in terms of criticizing the United States in foreign policies and et cetera. And of course, they don't like to see the United States as a hegemony or even sometimes concerned about the leadership. You know, this is something I told my students. The concept of leadership is also very interesting. Towards the end of the class, I told the students that Professor Lee will lead the class to celebrate the Christmas. And the students just laugh. Your leadership to go to the Christmas? No matter with or without you, we will celebrate Christmas. But in this country, we talk about President Al Gore will lead the world to 21st century, et cetera, this kind of leadership. So Chinese are actually quite cynical about even this kind of concept of leadership. So certainly they don't want themselves to be a leader towards that. Even they know that the country is on the rise. Now, actually, in terms of criticism of Bush's foreign policy, you do see strong criticism within the political establishment, particularly in the think tanks in China. These people actually usually trained in the United States, educated in the United States. They are more critical about Bush than others. But in the general public, if you go to China, Japan, or South Korea, or even Taiwan, actually Chinese public are very much supportive of the United States, even President Bush. There's so many people excited about the Iraq war. Actually, I did a survey. There are more people support the Iraq war in China than some other East Asian countries. So we may have different views, but this is the current status of the mindset of Chinese people, and including intellectuals and young people. But of course, if there's a crisis like EP3 or MC bombing, things could completely go a different direction.
Okay, last question.
Okay, this will be short. I wonder if you could comment on the dichotomy, as I understand it, between the remarkable progress and development in the urban areas of China and the relative stability or lack, even worse than that, in the rural areas. Isn't this another very severe problem for China?
Yeah, it has been a very severe problem for a long time, even during the Republican era and even beyond. But it's fascinating to see that that gap, urban-rural gap, start to reduce actually quite recently because of our policies. And of course, at early on, in the early 1980s, China's economic reform started in rural area. That helped reduce the gap. But then in the later 1980s and the entire 90s, China's urban development was far ahead of rural development, caused a tremendous gap. But at the same time, you do see the migrations, as early Professor Du Weiming mentioned. 200 to 300 people move from rural area to urban area. That tried for long term reduce the gap. But most recently, Hu Jintao actually did something very, very radical. Actually, the Western media hardly report that. They want to abolish the hukou system, the household registration system, which segregated rural China from urban China for many, many centuries. Now, they want to abolish. On one hand, it's already happening. People have freedom to go. Now they wanted to reduce or abolish all the favorable policy to urban areas. So this really liberated the Chinese, millions and millions of Chinese farmers. So for the long run, that will reduce the gap between rural China and urban China. What Wen Jiabao did the most during the past 3 years is to waive agriculture tax for 700 Chinese rural population. That's a tremendous help for farmers. So in a way, it started to reduce. And I foresee in the near future, this is the most dramatic change to China. Now the problem is how to accommodate them to the urban areas. That's a big challenge with environment, transportation, and energy, all these implications. That, I don't know the answer. To be honest, these areas, just when you think about these numbers, it's quite depressing in many ways. How could they find a solution? But what is remarkable of China, despite all these shortages, as we know that China has 20% of the world population, but 7% of the world's arable land, 7% of world fresh water, 3% of world forest, 2% of world's oil, and 1% of world's natural gas. Despite all these problems, the country still can move forward. That's a remarkable achievement.
All right, I think we'll leave it there on that somewhat optimistic note. Thank you, Li Cheng.
Thank you.